Welcome again. Today we have Chennai Mukumba with us to talk about tax. So welcome, Chennai.
Thanks, Crystal. Really, really excited to be on this platform. I've been waiting just because I'm an avid follower, and so really, really honored to be invited to talk. My name is Chennai Mukumba. Let's see, something about myself. I've lived in, I think, 6-7 different countries now, lived and worked in 6-7 different countries across 3 different continents. It's crazy to say that, but it really, I think, has opened up the way in which I view the world, different cultures, etc. And so really love that I have that kind of life story. In terms of my politics, like I was saying, no one has actually ever asked me that. I think the only time I recall being asked was when I was interviewing for my current position at TJNA, because at that time I was working for a very sort of neoliberal sort of capitalist institution, and we are definitely not that at TJNA. And so I think if I was to identify myself now, I would definitely say I lean towards sort of, you know, social democracy, pan-Africanist. That's the lens through which I sort of view the world, my work, at TJNA. I can't remember your last question. Do you want to remind me?
What do you do professionally? You've alluded to it, but we don't know what TJNA is and what do you do?
Yes. Of course. So professionally, I work at TJNA, which stands for Tax Justice Network Africa. TJNA is a network of civil society organizations. So we serve as a secretariat for a group of members. So we have about 40 different members in 20 different African countries. And by members, I'm talking about national, local civil society organizations who work on a whole host of different things. But what brings them together is this topic of tax, which, like you rightly indicated, is a very intimidating issue. But what we try to get these civil societies to see is that, for example, say you're a women's rights organization, and your big call every year when the budget comes out is we want to see this amount of the budget going to this particular issue, which we think is, you know, key to promote gender equality. What we encourage these civil societies to think about is the step before, right? So how much money these governments are generating through tax and how they're generating it, right? Because how they generate it at times can actually perpetuate gender inequality, right? So essentially creating a problem that you are going to want money to fix. But also secondly, the more money governments are able to generate, the more money you can then spend, right? And so I always use the argument, 10% of $10 is a lot less than 10% of 100, right? But we're much happier with 10% of 100. So how to, you know, ensure that the first part of the conversation is also part and parcel of our core. So I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you sort of answered my next question around, from an African perspective, why tax justice? We live, for many of us, we live in countries where the roads are potholed. We have to pay for private solutions for so many public problems, private healthcare, private education. And so when you're talking about tax justice, I'm finding it hard to like wrap my head around it, considering that it's so broken down. And on top of the breakdown, you're pushing me to pay a tax on top of that. So just like take us through that sort of ideation.
Yeah, and that's such an important question. In fact, we get that question a lot. So when we are arguing for tax justice, and you know, it incorporates a lot of the, you know, issues I mentioned earlier, right? So we're looking at how much countries are able to generate as well as how they're generating it, because that's equally important. But what you tend to find is that for many African countries, there is a significant amount of money that's leaving our countries, right? And so constraining African governments from spending money where it should be. And so a lot of the work that we do is to try get multinational corporations, high net worth individuals to pay their fair share and have them contribute larger proportions to government treasury. So often, Crystal, you're not the target, right? Because the most significant culprits within this conversation of tax justice are these two groups that I've spoken about. And so what we tend to advocate for is policies that can limit the amount of money that these multinational corporations are literally leeching, right, from our continents. And often the reason for this is because the global tax system has provisions that allow them, right, to take advantage of these loopholes. But also at a national level, like I was saying, really get governments to start thinking about how can they tax those who earn more through wealth taxes, for example, right? So stop targeting, you know, say, you know, the woman selling vegetables on the street, she's not your target. Really, let's look at those high net worth individuals, those, for example, who've come into money through inheritance, right? Let's tax that, let's tax property, because they already have so much to spare, right, but are not being taxed, and are also benefiting from, you know, the infrastructure that tax pays for. And so when we're talking about tax justice, we're really trying to have it be that those who can, those who earn the most, pay the most, in an effort to try and address this issue of inequality that we see in our countries.
Okay, so if I hear you correctly, you're not saying don't make a profit to multinationals or don't be wealthy, but there's a redistributory, that's even a word, role of taxation to redistribute wealth and allow for governments to be able to have the resources to spend on public services to have enough. I guess, like, you know, Oxfam's research, and I think their latest just came out just before Davos recently, that says during COVID, there's a new billionaire created every 30 hours. That's insane. Mm-hmm. Right? When so many people fell below the poverty line, there has to be surely some way to balance that out. And what I hear you saying is tax is a good instrument to make sure that we're not living in extremes. Okay, that's really helpful. I will continue to pay my taxes. So last year in June of 2021, this huge announcement in the tax space about a new minimum tax, right? Mm-hmm. Announced by the G7. And before I even get into that, you know, when I hear your conversations at the Tax Justice Network Africa, there's always conversations about, you know, the OECD and trying to make the tax base more inclusive, and the OECD isn't inclusive. So one, who is the OECD? And then I also hear about the G7, and I also hear about the G20. I have no idea who these groupings are, and I think many people would like to know. So just to get an idea and a sense of who they are, and especially from a lens of a tax perspective, why are they so important? Why are they central to the conversation?
Yeah, so the OECD is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. And what it is an intergovernmental sort of economic organization that's made up of 38 member countries. It was founded in sort of the early 1960s. And really what it is it's a group of some of the wealthiest countries that exist globally. African countries are not part of that organization. And so often when we're pushing back, and we'll talk about it a little bit later, is because the OECD plays a big role in sort of framing conversations, global economic trade conversations. But of course, you know, because there is very little African representation in these groups, it's the interests of those OECD countries that are pushed forward. So for example, the US is a member, the UK is a member, and those are the countries that are, of course, pushing their own interests within those conversations. The G7 is a smaller group of the richest of those OECD countries. And so within the G7, you've got Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the UK, and the US. And so really, it's almost like a subset of the OECD. And basically, these countries, the seven of them, in different literature, for example, they're referred to as sort of the club of rich countries. Often they're the ones that are sort of directing conversations that you then see the OECD push forward, because essentially it's a subset of that larger group. The G20, really similar countries, but you see within the G20, they tried, I'll put that in inverted commas to be slightly more inclusive. South Africa is a member of the G20, the only African country, but even within the G20, South Africa really is yards behind sort of, you know, the in terms of, for example, the economic situation of all the other G20 countries, but that was their effort to try and create something that was more inclusive because of the issue I raised earlier. There's no representation of African countries, of sort of lower income countries. And so because of that, there's a lot of pushback that these countries get. But really the different groups I've just spoken to are different iterations of countries that are contributing to global conversations, largely sort of wealthy developed countries.
So it's a group of wealthy countries. I'm assuming mostly global, not assuming, you did say global north. Absolutely. Countries. Very white. And then the G7 is, I guess, the 1% of the rich countries, if you will. Mm-hmm. And the G20 is an attempt to be a bit more inclusive, but even then within limits.
Exactly.
Another thing I hear you talk a lot about is this push and the fight to have the conversation and the framework setting around global tax at the UN rather than the OECD. And tell us a little bit more about that and why that's so important, especially considering that not very many people think that the UN is the most inclusive space. And if it's not the most inclusive space, then the OECD must be really bad. But why is that a push? And from an African perspective, why is that the best place that we could have it anywhere?
So the OECD currently, with regards to sort of the global tax conversation, is the institution that's spearheading these discussions. And I mentioned earlier, you know, it's a group of sort of 38 countries that are wealthy, et cetera. And so you can only imagine that if discussions about global tax reform are being spearheaded by these countries, the outcome of those conversations are going to be in the best interest of those countries. Now, the OECD, because of the backlash that it was receiving from really everybody else, developed what's called the inclusive framework, where they opened up, you know, sort of membership to other countries. So there's more African countries that are a part of this. But really, when you take a look again at the numbers, not all African countries are a part of this. In fact, I think only half of countries from the African continent are part of the inclusive framework. But even though, you know, this inclusive framework exists, members of the inclusive framework don't have voting rights. So still you've got very limited influencing, right, that you can make as a part of this framework. So the reason we, like you've indicated, the UN is not the most inclusive there. It has its faults. But the reason we still push for these conversations to happen at the UN, because you still have a situation that is much more inclusive in practicality, right? African countries are members of the UN. Every single country has equal voting rights, and you can have conversations at an equal playing field. There's no sort of distinction or hierarchy, you know, within the United Nations, particularly as regards to this conversation. And so even with its flaws, it still remains the best option for where these conversations can take place. In addition to that, for example, countries within the UN can form groups, right, and communicate decisions on that basis. So, for example, the G77, the group of African nations, has actually been pushing within the UN for there to be an intergovernmental body based at the UN, because they see the value of those conversations happening there.
Great, that's really helpful. And I guess it's up to us. Many of these things are constructs. So even with the UN, if we're able to come together as Africa, for example, and push with one voice for specific things, there is room and space for that to happen. So now I will pan out to, you know, the thing that was announced in June of last year of 2021, this, you know, minimum tax rate, and it was set at 15%. Yeah. I've heard, you know, various responses to that. A few of my private sector friends are like, wow, that, you know, we're here for that. But there's been such a resistance from African civil society, really spearheaded by the Tax Justice Network Africa, who you work with, other organizations like AfroDad, FemNet, Now We Ourselves. And so take us through, I know this part of two pillars, what's pillar two of two pillars. So what's pillar one, what's pillar two, but specifically, what's all the hue and cry about this 15%?
Yeah, so I think what we've been seeing lately is that with the digitalization of the economy, right, the way in which countries' trade, the way in which multinational corporations operate has changed, right? So now, for example, you don't necessarily need to have physical presence in a country to make, you know, sort of profit to generate revenue. And so because of this, a lot of countries have been grappling with, hold on a second, you're in our country. I mean, you may not be physically in our country, but you're benefiting, right, from being able to sell certain products, right, to our population. Surely there must be a way in which we're able to benefit from that because you are, you know, essentially using our resources. So there's been a conversation around, you know, how can we address this issue that's coming about as a result of the digitalization of the economy? So last year, like you rightly indicated, there was this discussion that really was the culmination of years of conversation about how can we really, you know, address this issue? Because particularly, for example, developing countries were finding themselves, you know, on the back foot, where countries are, particularly not just countries, but companies, you know, when you take a look at like Google, Facebook, et cetera, you know, they're making use or able to benefit from, you know, the consumers in those countries, yet, you know, they don't have presence, et cetera. So from the October decision, there were sort of two pillars of a proposal that was put forward. And so the first pillar, basically what it did is try to find ways so that multinational corporation profits could be distributed between, you know, both the country where, you know, a company is operating without physical presence, as well as, for example, you know, where it's headquartered, even though it may not have a physical presence there. And so that's what pillar one was supposed to help address. And then what pillar two was supposed to address, which is this issue that you want to talk about now, is this issue of countries being able to shift, not countries, but companies being able to shift their profits from one jurisdiction to the next in an effort to try and reduce their tax bill, right? So for example, let's say, you know, one country has a corporate income tax rate of about 25%, and the same company is operating in another country where it has a corporate income tax rate of about 10%, you know, essentially using different tools that it has to shift its profits from a higher tax jurisdiction to a lower tax jurisdiction so that its bill is much lower. So part of the reason we were really interested in this conversation is because African countries tend to have higher corporate income tax rates. So within the African continent, the average tax rate ranges between 25 to 30%, right? So if you are trying to do away with this profit shifting, right, essentially you would need to have a minimum tax rate that takes away the incentive for a multinational corporation to shift their profits from the African country to the next, right? So you can only imagine when, you know, there's now a conversation about the global minimum tax rate being 15%, how many African countries are thinking, well, that doesn't really affect or improve the situation we're in, because multinational corporations still have the incentive to shift, right, their profits from where they're operating in Africa at about 25%. To, you know, a lower tax jurisdiction where it's about 15%. And you know, we really pushed back on this as an institution for reasons that I've just spoken about, but also it's actually not that shocking that we came up, or they, not we, in fact, I'm gonna say we, that 15% was what's on the table, because this was the decision that was led and spearheaded by the OECD, right? And the OECD has a significantly lower corporate income tax rate, is home to countries such as Ireland, where the corporate income tax rate is closer to 12%, right? So the interest of those countries, right, their interest to essentially not do away with the way in which they're generating profit through profit shifting is what resulted in them landing at that number, which, you know, like you've already mentioned, like I've mentioned already, doesn't benefit African countries to any degree, really.
So, you know, the proposition was, the proposal was the G7, so it's the 1% of the rich countries. And this 1% of the rich countries, if you look at the map of resources, for example, they don't feature in that map, whereas a lot of African countries do, a lot of extractive industries, are held on the African continent. And so it's sort of, you know, very peculiar, and the power dynamics are really central to this conversation on who sets the agenda for tax and who's benefiting the most from it and where are the resources. Yet the countries with the most resources have the least say in setting up the tax framework. I actually have no say. You're right. And that's kind of blowing my brain a little bit that, you know, still in 2022, it sounds very racist, let's call it what it is. And I know Winnie Benyima at Davos was talking about racist policies around vaccine equity, and I, you know, it's the very same thing here. And so another thing that I know you're interested in is, one, the literature and the voices around Africans talking about this is really led by the Tax Justice Network Africa. What I find less and less of out there is a feminist analysis of tax in general and tax justice, and especially from an African perspective. So I know I hadn't spoken to you about this beforehand, but just as you were speaking, it just came to my mind. And I'm really interested in knowing if you have any insights as to why, and if there are people talking and writing about tax from an African feminist perspective, who might those be? Before I move on to the next few questions that I have.
So you know, this linkage between tax and gender is something that we've been thinking about a lot. And I know, Crystal, you and I have spoken about how there is such a lack of research, you know, that kind of speaks to tax, its implications on women, right? Just feminist taxation policies. There's a shift towards trying to do a lot more work, but really it's at best anecdotal, I think, at the moment. And I mean, I've done a few pieces where I've tried to sort of show the way in which some of these decisions at global level affect women, right? At the end of the day, for example, and this is sort of a very top line sort of reading, if you are not addressing a problem that's negatively impacting a country's ability to raise revenue, right? At the end of the day, the group that is most negatively affected are the most marginalized, right? And we know within the continent that that's women, right? The feminist face of poverty. So really the impact of that type of profit shifting, that type of resources flowing out of a country has a disproportionate effect on women. And so this is something that, you know, I've tried to sort of show in different pieces I've put together, but something that really begs attention, because I think if you're able to put numbers to it, we'd really be shocked. Because at the end of the day, you know, governments begin to try and raise revenue the best way they know how, the easiest way they know how. And sadly, the easiest way also tends to be the most harmful way for people who don't have sort of active voice in our conversations.
Great, thank you. It just came to my mind because we were talking about power globally.
Yeah.
And from a feminist perspective, power is central. And so that came to my mind. So back to the global minimum tax. And I guess, you know, you've talked about why Africans should care. And it can be a bit lofty, sort of hard for everyday African citizens to hold on to. So outside of the civil society space, outside of, you know, people who engage in policy every day, why should I, as an African citizen just trying to make ends meet, care about what happens with the global minimum tax and who sets it? Like, what does it matter to me?
Because I think it goes back to, you know, the point I made earlier about, you know, government's limited resources because of conversations that are having a global level have an impact on your life, right? On our sort of day to day. Because at the end of the day, you know, resources that governments are able to bring together are plowed into sort of public sector institutions, right? Whether it's education, health, et cetera, et cetera. And our ability to access those is just based on their availability, right? And if they're not available, you can't, et cetera. So we really should be interested in that conversation because it affects your access to public services. And also, you know, from a much more moral perspective, you know, particularly the most marginalized, the most poor are those who most need access to those resources, right? And so that's another reason for why we should be interested in that, you know, from a personal perspective. To the extent that, you know, the government isn't able to provide those services, we're still paying taxes. However, you won't find yourself at a public hospital, although you're paying for it. And so you end up going now to a private sector hospital because it provides better services, really paying twice for the same service, right? So it's something that, like I mentioned earlier, has implications on our day-to-day lives. And at the end of the day, also impacts our pockets directly.
Okay, so almost a year after this announcement, what's happening? Mm-hmm. What's the state of play? What's happening? And my very last question tied to that is, what's your call to action? What can people do at different levels? What can citizens do, but also what can civil society organizations do, and where do they engage? Like, what's the plan? What's the framing? What's a framework for engaging in this now that it's been announced and it's sort of, you know, the train has left the station, if you so will, although if it was up to me, I'd just burn the station down, but you know.
So there's been a lot of pushback, you know, from civil society organizations, but also, you know, not all of the African countries that were part and parcel of the conversations through the inclusive framework endorsed it, right? So specifically Kenya and Nigeria didn't endorse the deal, right? So there generally hasn't been consensus amongst all members of the inclusive framework that this should go on. But what I also find particularly interesting is that there are certain members of the inclusive framework that endorsed it, but have said that this is not saying we're going to do it, right? And so we've actually seen quite a few members of the inclusive framework actually question, you know, whether they're actually going to do it. And so because of that, we've seen the date for implementation pushed back because members such as the United States, for example, even they are questioning, you know, to what extent they can and will implement that. So it's in a current precarious position in terms of where it is. But of course, the OECD is going to continue to want to push for it to go forward. What also is particularly interesting is, and this is quite a recent development, there was a meeting 2 weeks ago that was hosted by the African Union and UNECA. And within sort of the resolutions that came from that meeting, one of the key statements that was within that document was a call for a UN tax body. Well, not really a UN tax body, but a tax convention that then serves as the basis for a UN tax body. But really, we can see our governments also wanting to shift the people who lead this conversation, well, that power from the OECD to the United Nations. It's interesting because it's really kind of one sentence, but it's something that I think if there's enough people behind that and you know, sort of articulating their support for that, could gain, you know, a lot of traction. And so, you know, some of the work that we're wanting to do at present with civil society is get them to start, you know, talking to their governments about this issue. At an individual level, members of parliament are also very key decision makers, right, within these conversations. And so also getting them to be cognizant of this thinking and potentially the implications of this deal. We found that many members of parliament, just because there's so many different issues that they're dealing with, if you bring it to the fore, are easy to sort of convince for why we need to be taking a stance to push, you know, for more African voices influencing global conversations. So it's often just informing your, you know, sort of member of parliament, but also just generally social media is a tool that I think has proved to be much more powerful than anyone ever anticipated. So communicating, you know, your thoughts around this, right? And then tagging, whether it's your government or the OECD or whatever, there's a lot of weight that can be put behind, you know, a movement of people that are all saying the same things. And so I think those are just a couple of ways that I think we're seeing this conversation evolving, and how as individuals we can also contribute to the discussion.
Twitter is such a powerful tool to like be able to access and communicate with people that we wouldn't usually have access to. So to help people along with that, what are the hashtags that you know TJMA is using or that the space is using to talk about these things? And I know you spoke about tagging your governments. Is there anyone else we should be tagging or focusing our tweets on just to help put as much pressure as we possibly can?
So I think the targets would be, first of all, the OECD, because they are the problem. But then also, you know, the African Union, these conversations are happening. And this year, particularly, there seems to be a real want on the part of the AU to begin to concretize their discussions around tax. So we're seeing for the first time ever the development of a tax strategy, right? Because it affects our ability to affect our own development and growth. So, you know, sort of tagging the AU, tagging your governments at those different levels, I think are important. And then even tagging media institutions within your countries, because media also is particularly influential. In terms of hashtags, we've had a few, but I think probably the most important one that we've had is tax the rich. First of all, hashtag tax the rich. And then also including within a tax deal, saying no to the G7. So that's been one of the key hashtags that we've been pushing forward.
And I guess the broader tax justice hashtag is stop the bleeding.
Of course, yes. Yeah.
Great. And so I'll end it with asking you, if you were to tweet the OECD, the G7 today, what would your tweet be that would end in a hashtag?
First of all, this would have been a great question to prepare me for, Crystal. but I think if I was to tweet something, it would really be something that would demand of the OECD that they allow the conversation move to the UN, because in fact, it's been the OECD, like I mentioned earlier, African governments have been calling for, you know, this conversation to move to the UN, but it's received so much pushback from the OECD because of that power, that control that they have. So if I was to do a hashtag, it would probably be move tax to the UN. Something along the lines of relinquish power.
Yeah, you know, hashtag stop the G7.
Exactly. Stop the G7, stop the OECD, etc.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks, Chennai. Right on time, 40 minutes. This has been so immensely enlightening. You've got such a way of like putting such technical information and processes in such an easy way to understand. So thank you so much for that, for spending some time with us this afternoon. And we're looking forward to talking to you soon, I hope. But just a big thank you.